Judges, chapter 9, verses 22 through 57, the end of that chapter, in which Abimelech will have his downfall. We discussed Abimelech's rise last week. He was one of Gideon's 70 sons, and after his father's death, he killed 68 of his brothers so that he could seize power. The men of Shechem crowned him king, but his one surviving brother cursed him, saying that fire would come from Abimelech to devour the men of Shechem, and fire would come from Shechem to devour Abimelech. And so this week we will discuss how he fell from power. If you have not yet read the passage, Judges 9, 22 through 57, I recommend that you pause and read it now. I have divided today's passage into four broad sections. First, we have in verses 22 through 25 a description of just how bad the relationship became between Abimelech and Shechem. Then, in verses 26 through 33, we have Gaal rising to prominence and denouncing Abimelech, setting the stage for war. Afterward, in verses 34 through 49, Abimelech attacked and defeated Shechem, and finally, in verses 50 through 57, Abimelech went on to attack Thebez, leading to his demise. So let's talk about this toxic relationship between Abimelech and the city of Shechem. After Abimelech was crowned king, he only reigned for 3 years. Not a very long time for a king. But then, as mentioned last week, the bad kings tended not to stick around for too long because their sins would find them out. Abimelech's kingdom did not extend far in time, but it is unclear how far it spread in distance. It seems clear that Gideon had sway in northern and eastern Israel, particularly in his home tribe of Manasseh, and likely also the bordering tribes of Ephraim and Issachar. Perhaps he was the chief judge over all of Israel. We might suppose that his 70 sons were to take over his jurisdiction and divvy that up. Last week's passage gave the impression that Abimelech wanted to be king over a city-state in Shechem, but today's passage makes it clear that his influence spread beyond that. Though, it may not have spread too far, because he did have trouble in Thebez, which was not that far away. According to verse 41, Abimelech didn't even stay in the city of Shechem, where he had set up his little empire. He stayed in Arumah. Arumah was a place of much less prominence. According to BibleAtlas.org, its location is uncertain, but it was probably situated about 5 miles southeast of Shechem, higher up in the mountains. Ruins have been excavated there of a town which, in much later times, was called El Ormah, so there may have been some connection there. We note in verse 30 that he had appointed one Zebul as the governor of Shechem. And I suppose we can see how such a thing might hurt the relationship with the Shechemites. The Shechemites had wanted their brother ruling over them and had likely expected to increase their own power and influence in the city of Shechem, but instead they found themselves ruled over from another city, which is never popular, and particularly when expectations have not been properly managed. Verses 23 and 24 tell us that there was an evil spirit of animosity between Abimelech and Shechem. I think that's interesting language, an evil spirit. It is possible that God literally sent a demon, an evil spirit, to torment the people of Shechem in their relationship with Abimelech. How exactly the work of an evil spirit would be performed so as to make Shechem and Abimelech hate each other is unclear, but it is a possibility. Then again, it might also just be an expression. The word for spirit is the same as the word for wind or breath or some other related things. Maybe an evil wind between two parties just describes mutual dislike, or a bad word spoken from one to the other to make them not get along. Whatever the case, this animosity would fulfill the prophetic curse which had been spoken by Jotham, and that curse, of course, had been made justly. The Shechemites and Abimelech deserved their misfortunes because of their roles in murdering the other sons of Gideon. And furthermore, the spiteful relationship was to be expected. Both Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem were bad people, as demonstrated in that they did bad things, and each party knew that the other was corrupt. With that information, it's no surprise that neither side trusted the other side, and when the trust goes, the relationship goes with it. If you expect your counterpart to deal deceitfully, you keep your guard up. You don't help him, and he does the same with you. Both sides work to serve their own interest and eventually stop caring if the other side gets hurt. And when the other party does get hurt, it only fuels a downward spiral into a worse and worse relationship. So only a few years after crowning Abimelech king, the leaders of Shechem were so displeased with Abimelech's reign that they were ready to kill him. Literally. Abimelech didn't live in Shechem anymore, but evidently he did visit there from time to time, and so the leaders of Shechem set men in the hills with orders to ambush Abimelech whenever he passed by. However, Abimelech did not pass by because he was aware of the scheme. Perhaps the governor Zebul had found out about it and reported it to Abimelech. Evidently, this was a strong force of men up in the hills. They could have reasonably been expected to overtake a royal caravan. Zebul must have known the men were out there, whether or not he knew their purpose or had been the one to report them, because they had been taking to robbing travelers, but he did nothing to stop them. I get the impression that Zebul knew Abimelech was unpopular, and so despite his own faithfulness to Abimelech, he had to go along with the crowd to some extent in order to keep his own head. So the relationship between Abimelech and his hometown was as bad as it could get. The Shechemites hated Abimelech and wanted him dead, and they had taken to just openly committing crimes in defiance of Abimelech and undermining his reign. And it is in this context that a man named Gaal rose to prominence. Gaal, son of Ebed, moved into Shechem. His tribe is not mentioned, but evidently he was related to the Shechemites. It is possible that he even had some sort of Canaanite affiliation, since he mentions Hamor, former Canaanite king of Shechem, in verse 28. If that was the case, then he might have claimed to be the ultimate Shechemite, one who preceded even Israel. And little surprise, the Shechemites put their trust in him. They were a people who liked their leadership to be local. They were particularly fond of their own relatives, and perhaps more importantly, they were the kind of people to rally behind anyone with a big mouth. I think it is safe to presume that the people of Shechem started imagining that their assassins would remove Abimelech and that Gaal would be their new leader. And so the grape harvest came, and with it the people began eating and drinking and cursing Abimelech. We note that this was done in the house of their god, not Jehovah, the one true god of the universe, but likely Baal-Berith, or some other pagan god. And during the feast, Gaal spoke up to speak against Abimelech. First, he questioned why the people of Shechem were loyal to Abimelech. He pointed out that Abimelech was not really their brother, as they thought. His mother had been a Shechemite, sure, but his father had been Gideon, a.k.a. Jerubbaal. Gideon was no Shechemite. Gaal asserted that the people of Shechem ought to serve a Shechemite alone, represented by the city's ancient ancestral father, Hamor. Now, if you don't remember Hamor, his is a name that we have seen before. He showed up back in Genesis as the father of the young woman who raped Jacob's daughter, Dinah. So Abimelech had won Shechem's support, they had said, because he was the brother of Shechem, but then, as soon as they were dissatisfied with him, they went to find someone even more Shechemite to replace him. It isn't a very good standard for choosing leaders, and my supposition is that it was more an excuse to cover for their true intentions of just being rebellious than it was anything. Gaal's use of Gideon's alternate name, Jerubbaal, might also be an indicator that he is appealing to Shechemite religion. He was pointing out that Gideon was one against whom Baal contended. If the people served Baal, why should they serve a son of Jerubbaal? Having satisfied the people that he would be a better ruler than Abimelech, he called the people to action. He made clear his desire that the people of Shechem should follow him, and said that if they would do so, he would call Abimelech to battle to decide the matter. But that would not happen as Gaal might have hoped. Evidently, Zebul the governor was in attendance. Gaal may have thought that Zebul was friendly to the revolutionary mentality, but like most politicians, Zebul was playing to the crowd while serving his own ends. Or maybe Zebul wasn't even there, but the rumors of what had been said simply made it to his ears. Loose lips sink ships. And so Zebul sent a message to Abimelech, warning him that the city was preparing for outright rebellion. For that reason, he encouraged Abimelech to preemptively strike, setting up his men by night and preparing to rush on the city to take it by surprise as soon as possible. And Abimelech responded. He brought out a group of men in four companies. How many were in each company and how many total is unknown, but he brought enough to do the job, and when Gaal came out of the city walls, when he was away from his people and his protections, Abimelech sprang his trap. His men began running down from their hiding places in the hills to surround Gaal. Gaal was with Zebul at the time. Perhaps Zebul had brought him out specifically so that he could deliver him up. But Abimelech must have sprung the trap too soon, because Gaal immediately noticed the men coming from their places, and he called out to Zebul to let him know. Gaal had no idea this was coming, and likely he first thought that these were raiders from a foreign land, not Abimelech's army. He probably expected that Zebul would want to take measures to defend the city. Or perhaps he was thinking that Zebul was on his side, and he thought that Zebul would want to ride to the defense of Shechem even if he recognized Abimelech. But Zebul clearly was not on Gale's side. He tried to buy more time for Abimelech's men to surround Gale by telling him that he had made a mistake. These weren't men coming down from the mountains, he said, but just the shadows of the trees shifting in the sunrise. And that, I think, is pretty silly. Trees don't make the sound of galloping horses, and you'd have to be nearly blind to mistake a man riding a horse for the shadow of a tree. Gale didn't fall for this, and he corrected Zebul. He noted two of the four companies, one coming down from what he called the center of the land and another coming from the Diviner's Oak. Specific directions today, uncertain. We note, though, that a Diviner's Oak was evidently a prominent place such that people used it for orienting themselves. Divination was not a good practice, but obviously someone in idolatrous Israel was doing it beneath an oak tree. Zebul knew, with Gale giving such specific instructions, that the moment of deception was past, and so he mocked Gale with the truth. You said that you wanted to fight Abimelech? Well, there he is. Go fight him. Gale evidently had time to ride back to the city at that point and called the men to arms. They rode out against Abimelech and, in their unprepared state, were quickly defeated. They were beaten back to the city gates, many men were wounded, and Gale himself, along with his relatives, evidently escaped. Maybe to Thebes. And as students of the Bible, we should have enough knowledge to know what would naturally happen next. A siege, in which everyone in the city would try to hunker down behind the safety of the walls and wait out the attack. But that's not quite how things went down here. Either the Shechemites lacked the provisions for a siege, such that they needed to sneak out into the fields, or Abimelech's men hid themselves, feigning that they had left, and giving the Shechemites a false sense of security about leaving the city, believing that there would be no siege. Well, no such luck for Shechem. When the Shechemites came out of their walls, Abimelech rushed down on them. He killed the people in the field and seized the city gates, which both allowed him access to the city and stopped anyone in the field from fleeing to the city for safety. With the gate under his control, Abimelech was able to breach the walls, and Shechem was left with no defense but their skills in hand-to-hand combat. The Shechemites fought Abimelech all that day, but Abimelech killed them all and tore down their walls and, in a particular display of cruelty, salted the land. This was the way that an ancient conqueror would treat his worst enemies. If he really, truly hated a city, it wasn't enough to just kill its people, and it wasn't enough to just tear the city down. No, in truly hated cities, a conqueror would sow the ground with salt. Crops and grass for grazing couldn't grow with high levels of salt in the soil, so sowing salt into the ground would make the land unusable, and thus there would be no motivation to rebuild the city. Salting the ground meant subjecting a place to total destruction. Here, then, Abimelech was showing a particularly harsh overkill. This was a city in which a few leaders and one prominent person were rebelling, but rather than simply decapitating the leadership, Abimelech had rolled in with the intent of completely annihilating the city. This is the ancient equivalent of dropping a nuclear weapon on a city just because some radical ideologues had taken control of the city council. Quite extreme. The leaders of Shechem managed to escape the carnage, though. They were called here the leaders of the Tower of Shechem, which evidently is a reference to the fortified part of the city which Abimelech had just breached. They left the walls and they hid out in a stronghold on Mount Zalmon. This Mount Zalmon is evidently the same as Mount Ebal, just north of Shechem. Depending on what translation you're reading, you might find the stronghold called the House of El Bereth. El, you will note, is the Hebrew word for God, or a god. So it is the general consensus that the place was the temple of a god called Bereth. However, it is also possible that the word Bereth means covenant, so it might be a house of worship to the God of the Covenant, which I suppose could be Jehovah, the one true God, or really anybody else who would be called by that name. Whatever the case, the Shechemites who had escaped the city went to hide out in the stronghold, but Abimelech chased them there. He directed his men to cut down some brush, and they burned the building down over their opponents' heads. All in all, about 1,000 people died in the attack against Shechem. And thereafter, Abimelech attacked Thebes. Now, how much time had passed is not mentioned, so this could be an entirely different campaign. Thebes had not been mentioned prior to this point, which leads me to think that this might be a completely separate incident. But who knows? Maybe Abimelech had to put down an uprising in Shechem and decided it would be a good time to go ahead and knock some sense into anyone else who wouldn't submit. Thebes might have been one such place. Or, as mentioned before, maybe this is where Gale ran to, and so Abimelech thought he needed to get rid of him to stop him from stirring up further unrest. Thebes was a bit farther north than Shechem, so If Abimelech wanted to go there, he was already on the way, and this is the direction that Gale likely would have fled in. At Thebes, things looked like they were going to turn out the same way that they did at Shechem. The people shut themselves up in a tower to defend themselves, and Abimelech got the idea that he'd just burn the tower down to make an end of them. Thebes, however, was not under any divine curse, and Abimelech met a sudden end which would become a point for military tacticians for generations to come. We note, for example, that David would mention this defeat in discussing military tactics with Joab, as recorded in 2 Samuel 11:21. Abimelech's mistake was that he got too close to the tower, where people above could throw things down on him. A woman dropped a millstone, and it crushed Abimelech's skull. This didn't kill him, though. It just left him incapacitated, such that he knew he would die. And Abimelech knew what that meant. If a woman killed him with a millstone, he'd be subjected to the same kind of mockery which had surrounded Canaanite general Sisera. You may recall, just a few generations prior, that Sisera had been killed by a woman in the story of Deborah and Barak. A death at the hands of a woman, we noted there, was particularly humiliating. Abimelech wasn't about to go down like some punk killed by a girl, so he called on his armor-bearer to kill him instead, so that he could avoid the humiliation. The armor-bearer did so. And in the final verses, we have the epilogue. Abimelech was dead. No more king, no more war. Everyone went back home, and Israel returned to its very loosely governed affairs. In the end, Abimelech and Shechem had gotten what they deserved. They had killed the sons of Gideon to set up an evil king, and so the evil king turned around and killed the Shechemites. He then went on to die a humiliating death himself. As for the lessons, well, I don't have much deep spiritual advice to give you here, aside from the obvious points like don't kill all of your brothers so that you can be king, or don't pick a person to be king who is so unscrupulous that he will kill anyone in his path to power. We discussed most of the more philosophical points of the story, like the political ramifications and the way that evil tends to find itself out and so forth last week, but there are a few practical things to be learned here, particularly from Gale's big mouth. Loose lips sink ships. If you are talking about your battle plans, then you'll get yourself in trouble. So whatever you're engaged in, you'd better be careful who you trust with it. They say that if you're going to shoot the king, you had better not miss, and I will add to that that if you're going to talk about shooting the king, don't. They also say not to count your chickens before they're hatched. Gale thought that he could defeat Abimelech if Abimelech showed up, but obviously he couldn't. Maybe he should have boasted less and trained more. Other than that, I suppose that we should all do well not to get too close to the wall of a city under siege, if we ever find ourselves in that situation. And with that, we conclude Judges chapter 9. Herein, we learn the story of Abimelech. Abimelech rose to power on the backs of his dead brothers, and ultimately he paid for it with his life. Ironically, the men who installed him as king came to regret it when he turned around to kill them. So then, join us again next week when we'll be back with the next chapter of Judges.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.